I guess we didn't talk about how we're going to start this. I'll start. Hi, everyone. This is Guns Unpacked. I'm your co-host, Jenny Carlson.
And I'm your co-host, Alex Young.
Are we allowed to use Unwrapped? Does Spotify control that? Okay, but let's do one more. This is Guns Unpacked, Unwrapped for 2025. Or it could be Guns Unwrapped and just forget the unpacked.
You could say Guns Unpacked, or should we say Guns Unwrapped 2025? No, maybe we're overthinking this.
So welcome to 2025, December. We finally made it to the end. I don't even know what to say about this year, but what we've decided to do, Guns Unpacked listeners, is to actually end with a co-hosted event with just the co-hosts, Alex and myself, and we are here. We thought highlights were maybe too strong of a word, too much positivity for 2025. So we have a list of the five most memorable moments of 2025. We have not shared our lists. That's what we're going to talk about today on Guns Unpacked.
Yeah, and as we were talking about this, if the highlight word is the wrong word, I do think we were focused in this year where there has been so much happening related to gun culture, gun violence in the news, everything from the assassination of Charlie Kirk to the, you know, shooting at Bondi Beach, which we're still kind of processing. It just happened a week before we're recording this. But we're kind of focused on our work at the Bridges Initiative and the kind of conversations that we've had. So if they're not highlights, I like to think that they're productive moments for me that emerged from the sometimes difficult work we've had the privilege of doing together at the Bridges Initiative.
So do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
Why don't you go first?
Given the gravity of the last year, I feel like starting with this is like super small. But I don't know, it kind of captures the odd, uncanny feeling of this year, among many feelings of this year. And so actually, I want to talk about our swag. So I'm going to talk about swag. And, you know, in some ways, I mean, if you don't know, ASU is really into swag. ASU is really into branding. That's like our thing. And so obviously at Bridges, we are super excited about branding and swag. We've had some really awesome swag moments. We have a camo hat that has the Guns Unpacked logo on it. Super excited about that. We got Stanley Cups. Like we've been like doing the swag. The actual memorable moment or the thing I wanted to talk about is I was really excited. And this, I think the brand has to go unnamed. It was a athleisure company. I can't name it, but you can guess. And we got all of our proofs. We got, you know, our logo. And again, you know, we are bringing research and innovation into the debate on guns in society. So we're not about being pro-gun, anti-gun, or anything. But we do say the word gun, which apparently is a problem because we got rejected. And actually, my understanding is that it was the branding review, whatever, whatever office within this company that was basically like, we don't want that on our clothes. And the reason I bring that up is because I think it really speaks to the kind of chilling effects. You know, everybody's talking about funding being withdrawn and, you know, words being banned and, you know, all these kinds of more like overt chilling effects. But there's also been, I think, like sort of this much more subtle just not wanting to go there, not wanting to have the conversations, not wanting to like, and I mean, literally, I think it was just like the word gun was in our logo, was in our name. And so this was just not going to happen. We are all about having the hard conversations at Bridges on Guns Unpacked. And this obviously also, I think, ties into even our sort of shifting, if you've been following our social media, even saying the word gun, like spelling it out, if you... You notice we got all of this advice to promote the podcast that you can't have the word gun because the algorithm won't like it. And, you know, some of that is just sort of, you know, Silicon Valley speak, whatever. But I think there is this like real tension about having even saying the word, not even what you say about the word. And so, again, it's so small. It seems so silly almost given everything that we've experienced to talk about swag. But there is something I think really telling about that and the moment that we're in.
Yeah. I mean, our whole adventure with the marketing and even naming and kind of communication about the work we've done has really opened up something for me, kind of within that work, right? Like thinking about how do we as Americans kind of self-censor on this topic? How does this fear of the social media algorithm kind of impact what people allow themselves to say? And then, you know, on this particular marketing decision with the athleisure brand, I mean, I was just stunned by that. On a lighter note, though, I do have to say, when I first started working with the Bridges Initiative, it was your kind of like enthusiasm for swag and particularly like making stuff associated with your favorite brands where I was like, I love this. I was slightly intimidated by this space, but now I feel the freedom to do things like suggest we get camouflage hats.
Yeah, that was actually all Alex. So I don't want to at all take any credit for the incredible hats.
I like that we have both the Stanley Cup and the camo hat. I feel like it's the yin and the yang of the Bridges Initiative.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's what I think is also, you know, special about how, and this is, I'm sure, going to come up with some of our other memorable moments, is I think we have a sort of everybody's invited to the party, and that's, you know, even down to our brands. But some people will disinvite themselves, I guess, and that's the unfortunate part. That's what we didn't see coming, is that people would disinvite themselves from the party.
Yeah, and maybe they'll come to regret it. I like to hope so.
Maybe. Maybe if you're listening and you know who you are.
Yeah.
So sad you can't be in our amazing lineup of swag.
My first highlight slash dramatic moment is maybe more on a serious note. It was my interview with Jan Dizard on Guns Unpacked, which I got the opportunity to write about on our Substack after that. But I proposed that interview first thinking, oh, you know, like hunting culture is a very small kind of subculture within gun culture writ large. But nonetheless, I think it'd be something interesting to do. I knew Jan Dizard and his work from Amherst College, where we were both on the Copeland Colloquium focused on guns there in the 2015-2016 academic year. And I, you know, knew he was an interesting scholar. But as I started preparing for that interview, I just came to realize how much about Jan's work modeled for me the work that I hope we're able to do together here. I had never picked up, somewhat to my shame, his edited collection, Guns in America. And going through that and thinking about his ability to produce that with both academic and activist voices that he was able to bring together on both sides of the debate and create that document just stunned me. And I was so impressed just with that book that I, you know, really started thinking about Jan as a person and the kind of joy he brought to scholarly endeavor. That's not a characteristic associated with academics a lot these days. I mean, I think in part because we're trained to be critical thinkers, in part because the academy in general, especially in 2025, is facing so many profound challenges. But Jan was always somebody who was able to face those with a critical mind without kind of losing the incisiveness of his scholarship, but also being able to walk into any room with a smile on his face and engage people of different perspectives. And he was like that right up to that interview, which did sadly end up being, I think, one of his last public-facing things that he was able to do. I learned just kind of by accident from friend of Bridges, Jonathan Obert at Amherst, that he had passed away of a heart attack quite suddenly, just a few months after I did that interview. And Jan had been a friend and a mentor and somebody I really looked up to before, but I think all those feelings were kind of redoubled thanks to the opportunity to interview him, talk with him about the work we're doing, which I think we're often tempted, for me anyway, in a kind of slightly self-centered kind of way to think like, you know, this moment in gun studies is something totally new, right? And in some ways it is, right? I do feel like there's a community of scholars, and I'll talk more about this in some of my other points, that's coming together now like nothing we've ever really seen in this debate, in this field. But it does have a history, right? And Jan's work, to me, really has stood out as I've been so immersed in this work this year as a model for how I want to do it.
Yeah, it's funny. Thinking back to the very first things that I read when I was like, oh, I should study guns. This is a good idea. Really being totally clueless as a graduate student, I came across that volume And now I'm like, you know, because it's an interesting volume because it has activists and academics. And so some of it, you know, I remember reading it and being like, how do I use this to do sociology, right? Like I'm thinking about building, you know, theory and you know, my methods and whatever. I feel like when I read it, I was like, you know, I don't know what to do with this, right? There was no, that wasn't clear. But now that I'm looking back, I'm like, oh, was that when I got this crazy idea that this was possible? that speaking across the gun debate, like I'm like, I never felt, I remember that being one of the first things I read and just being like, I don't know what to do with it. But like, I guess it knew what to do with me because now we're here.
Oh my gosh, that's an amazing story.
Yeah. And it's, and I mean, who are all the people? Charlton Heston.
I mean, yeah, like all the, it was, like, you know, the president of the NRA.
Yeah.
It was really remarkable that he was able to get that crowd on board. And in the interview, you know, he was able to talk about that as something he'd faced from both left and right over the course of his career, his attempts to kind of bring people together on these conversations and sometimes facing rejection and sometimes not. And Jan's ability to kind of plow through that moment in the early 2000s, I think of as like the dark ages of gun studies after the arming of America controversy when it was stripped of the Bancroft and the kind of dry labbing of data was revealed. That had such a profound chilling effect that I faced at the beginning of my career with mentors saying, you shouldn't do this. Haven't you heard of this book?
Yeah.
And I know that you had similar stories there. But, you know, you look at Jan's publication record and Belial was in that book, right? Mm. But Jan just was like undeterred. He like kept publishing on gun culture and thinking about this work all through that period when it was very hard to do so. So his stories about the rejections as well as the successes in his efforts to build those bridges were inspiring to me.
Yeah. And I guess I feel like what's really different, it really felt like there was this sense, you know, the assault weapon ban, it was gonna sunset, but hadn't totally yet. You know, it's around this period where we have Columbine, but we're not yet at Sandy Hook. And it almost seems like there's this sort of sense of like, maybe it'll all just go away. Like the academics having this sense of like, maybe this problem will just kind of float off. And no one would say that now. I mean, no one, I mean, people were saying that in 2010 when I was starting my research of like, sort of like, how is this, like, do we really need to talk about this? And I'm like, well, there's this thing called shall issue and stand your ground that, you know, you in California might not think is relevant to you. But it is, I think it is interesting that no one would ask the question, why would you study this? They might ask a lot of questions about how you're going about studying it, but the question of whether this is worthy of study and worthy of building a career on, I think is not there anymore, which I don't know. Is that a good thing? But at what cost, right? At what cost not having that question?
Yeah.
But okay, I'll do my next one. This isn't like one moment. This is more a overarching sort of many, many moments, but I want to highlight all of the exciting work that we've had in the way of global gun studies. So I feel like when I look back on this year, there have been so many moments. So from the symposium to the podcast to the next symposium that we're going to have, I mean, I'm just super, super excited about the amount of work that's being done that is actually decentering the U.S. or rethinking the U.S., not as a sort of standalone case, but really in relation to not just gun markets. I think that usually the gun industry and thinking about when we say global gun studies, usually it's almost immediately a conversation about like traffic in small arms. But what we've seen is sort of a shift toward thinking about like the circulation of gun politics in the U.S. versus other places. We've seen, obviously, the circulation of guns themselves with the U.S.-Mexico border and work on that, but we're thinking much more in terms of politics and culture as well. And so, you know, I just want to highlight at the symposium, Isaac Rainey, Mayor, I might be mispronouncing her name, Maya, Laura Vargas, Noah Schwartz, who is at the symposium and also on the podcast coming up, doing work on Canadian gun culture, Yeva Yasionita. I hope that I just pronounced that correctly. She not only was on our podcast, but she also just won the MacArthur. So that's super exciting. Dulce Torres, who does work on gun violence and trafficking in Mexico. She's going to be at the symposium in 2026. There's just a lot of really exciting work happening in terms of thinking beyond the U.S. in terms of gun studies. And so I think this is where like the shift from like, you know, having your own research agenda versus running an initiative like this, you get to really support the work that maybe I'm not necessarily ready to jump into, but I can see everybody sort of doing this work and we can provide forums to get this work out there to our podcast listeners. That's my second memorable many, many moments.
Wow. Yeah, that, you know, that list of names you shared there does make me realize what an exciting kind of facet of Bridges' work that has become. And I mean, it's certainly been on my mind as a scholar who does a lot of U.S. comparative work, actually mainly outside of my work as a gun scholar, although teaching, I work on U.S.-Australia comparisons a surprising amount within gun studies. I was just on the phone this morning with my friend Mike Griffiths, postcolonial studies scholar at University of Wollongong, talking through with him, just first kind of checking in on Jewish friends and colleagues in the Sydney area who we knew and making sure everyone was all right and all that, but then talking about where that political conversation is going. And I think we may be entering into another one of those moments where US-Australia kind of comparisons are really top of mind as we see where their policy discussion goes. Gosh, yeah. Well, I'm glad your second one was kind of more nebulous, because I think my second one is more nebulous too. It feels like a moment kind of in my own intellectual development, I guess, but maybe a series of moments in terms of the connections I felt so lucky to make at Bridges. As a scholar of race and gun culture, I've kind of come at questions of race and guns from an unusual perspective, being more kind of focused on Indigenous studies, the history of settler colonialism, than other aspects of race in America. But, you know, from my very earliest work, thinking about Black gun cultures has been central to what I do. So much of my focus has been on history and the kind of work on Black self-defense through the civil rights movement, et cetera, that I really felt like this year was the first time in my career where I felt like I had a better grasp on the social science conversation on gun violence prevention in Black communities and how really through the networks starting to be created in gun studies, it was kind of coming into conversation with some of that historical conversation that I was more familiar with. So for me, meeting Yasser Payne, Brooklyn Hitchens, Daryl Chambers at our last symposium was an amazing moment, and being able to read Murdertown USA, thinking about the work they were doing in their community and the work they were doing within the academy to challenge so many of the norms and kind of presuppositions we have about how research in the communities most impacted by gun violence in the United States should work. That was really inspiring for me, as well as meeting in a couple of different contexts, Gerald Higginbotham, and learning more about his work and hearing his interview with you on the podcast. And then finally bringing it back to some of that more historically focused conversation, talking to Kelly Carter Jackson for our season two. That interview will be released here in a few months. But sort of through all those interactions, I was really able to get a sense of where I think that conversation might be going and what we as the Bridges Initiative might be able to do to facilitate some of the connections across that kind of humanities, historian, social scientist divide to really get everybody thinking more about this question of what do we do with that history of Black collective self-defense that has mobilized Black gun owners under the Second Amendment to push back against racial terror versus the social science on these communities where one of the imperatives is to get young men to put down guns when the toll of gun violence has been so intense in these communities that people like Daryl and Yasser work within. So watching that conversation come together, feeling like I had a more holistic understanding of it, a growing understanding, I should say, I'm not an expert, but has been super rewarding for me and has been transformative in my own thinking.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that's really powerful there. Chad King, who is the Midwestern chair coordinator of the National African American Gun Association and also runs or founded the Black Bottom Gun Club in Detroit, he actually came to my class several years ago, actually, when I was at the University of Arizona. I think my students were not prepared for his presentation. I mean, just the history, the social science, the everything, kind of weaving it all together. And at the end of the presentation, he was kind of playing with this idea of gun culture 2.0, which a term used within gun culture, as well as popularized by David Yamane, that's really focused on gun ownership and carry and practice being around self-defense. Chad King had this, kind of rhetorical question at the end where he was like, what if gun culture 2.0 is just black gun culture? And I just thought that was like the perfect summary. Like it was the perfect, like, this is actually what's been going on this whole time. But, thinking about sort of how you kind of laid out those conversations coming together, I mean, I think what I really appreciate about Kelly Carter Jackson's work, all of the scholars that you've mentioned, Yasir Payne, Daryl Chambers, like they, and I think this is something that I think particularly scholars who find themselves invested in this topic outside of this conversation, they are not invested in the terms of the gun debate. And in fact, are able to open up space, I mean, intellectually, but also politically, because they are not invested in the same way that, the people who tend to set the terms of the gun debate, disproportionately white men on both sides, that's changing a little bit. But, I think there's something really there both to question, like, where does this investment in this binary gun debate, this zero-sum gun debate come from? And also, like, really look at this literature as the model for, like, this is the kind of conversations and what you open up when you totally just let that go. So I really appreciate that. And I think the other thing I wanted to just mention, and this actually is a segue, unless, did you want to jump in? Did you want to say something?
Oh, I mean, I have all kinds of thoughts on this. Chad's comment is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
In part, of course, coming at it from an idiosyncratic place, I feel like so much of David Yamane's narrative of gun culture 2.0 is this move away from hunting to self-defense. Just made me think of the folks I hope to interview, like the directors of Hunters for Color and stuff in season 3. But that's a little preview. But then, yeah, I mean, your thing about the keywords of the conversation are totally different, right? It's not just the binary terms of the political debate, right? But like the investment of kind of conversations about white gun culture in right speak, broadly construed, and the Second Amendment as this kind of overriding concern. Like, I feel like
I don't think it's a difference.
That conversation
I don't think it's a difference in an investment in right speak. I think that there is an investment in rights across the board, but it's this investment of thinking about rights as individualistic. These abstract, individualistic, entitlements that really are totally disjointed from community care, mutual aid, thinking about the collective. And I think that's where, and it's funny because, when you talk to some, like when I was doing my research for Citizen Protectors, I remember there was this one middle-aged white guy, Democrat, who was like, the Second Amendment isn't just about our individual rights. It's also about the community, but nobody wants to talk about that. I feel like American gun cultures, plural, are always so, because rights are at the center, but what is responsibilities versus rights, it's mutual aid versus individual. So it's like how those rights come to be actualized that I feel like is really different. I think this is also where Kelly Carter Jackson's decision to highlight Black women in her book, which is huge, but also to think about not just resistance, but refusal. I think that's also where we get something really different. And so we're really thinking sort of in a much more expansive way with that work.
Yeah. And I guess that's, I was kind of using the term right speak probably a little too fast and loose to kind of refer to that kind of individualistic abstract framing of how we understand these things. Whereas the kind of central question of rights certainly extends across those spaces. But it's just these kind of exchanges that I guess I feel like learning from those scholars kind of brought to my work this year, and I've been so grateful for it.
There's a link between that and my third moment, which again is a collection of many moments. But one of the things that I really love about Murdertown USA is that it really is based on this totally different way of thinking about research. So this is not extraction of knowledge for the purposes of serving someone's career. This is a JobWorks program. This is a, and so, and if none of that makes sense, listeners, like go listen to our episodes with on Murdertown USA.
Yeah, which is dropping in next month. So that'll be convenient.
So I'll let you dig deep into what that means. But again, a very different way of thinking about expertise, of what research is. And kind of in a parallel way, we at Bridges and with the research team that I have with the American Gun Experience Project have also sort of been coming up with sort of different ways of thinking about what research is and how it serves the public, right? How it serves the public, and, you know, being at a public serving institution like ASU, you know, what does that mean? And so this year, and I'll just kind of very briefly talk about the American Gun Experience. So this is a project funded by Russell Sage Foundation. We have, I think, almost a dozen trained researchers, undergraduates, graduate, postdoc, who are engaged in basically building this, we're calling it data infrastructure, a very large database of interviews with people in the U.S. on their experiences with guns. That could be ownership, that could be violence, that could be consumption of gun media. We kind of are coming at this with the idea that there are many ways that people in the U.S. are experiencing guns in their lives. And in fact, oftentimes, because we want to have these tight, neat research projects that, you know, are going to result in something, you know, tangible at the end, we end up taking slices, right? We take a slice of the American Gun Experience. And so we can't see how everything kind of works together. So that's exactly what this project is supposed to do. And so what's been fascinating, so just, and again, not to get too much in the weeds, the way that we sort of orchestrated this, because people are always like, how do you find them? How do you, like, you just find, you know, how do you know you're getting a sample across the U.S.? So we actually worked with Ameri-Speaks to field nationally representative surveys to get a basic profile of people in the U.S. on a variety of gun measures. And then out of that survey, we recruited people to interview with us. We did this over the course of 2025. So this is when higher ed research funding has been decimated. This is when Charlie Kirk was assassinated. This is when, I mean, there's moment after moment after moment where sort of the things that I think sometimes researchers in our like little ivory tower were like, oh, we should wait until after the election because we don't want to confound our interview. Well, we didn't really have a choice, right? Like we were just kind of in this and actually very much in real time talking to people. And in some ways, and this is where it connects back to like rethinking what research is, actually giving people a space to process what I think we can all collectively agree is a lot of heavy, chaotic stuff to process, right? Some of the stuff that's come out, and I think this is where, you know, this is a thank you to my research team. This is a thank you to the people who have already talked to us. We're still recruiting and doing the interviews. But the openness with which people have shared their, and I'm going to call it gun ambivalence. You know, so there's, if we look at the data, a third of people in the U.S. own a gun personally. And then usually it's presented as like, you know, only like, and this is obviously a very politicized way of presenting it, you know, only a third of people in the U.S. own guns. And so blah, blah, like, why do we have the politics we have? Well, that assumes that everybody who doesn't own a gun is like diametrically opposed to the idea, right? And that is false. So we actually know from Pew data that about a third own guns, a third are like, I might own a gun in the future, and a third are like, absolutely no way, never going to happen. It's very hard to get to those people who are ambivalent because like they're not hanging out at the shoot. Well, some of them might be hanging out at the shooting range as they decide whether they want to purchase a gun. So we've been able actually to talk to a lot of those people. You know, so we're able to ask questions like, oh, you don't own a gun. Is there a particular reason why you don't? And it's been fascinating to hear people say things like, I don't own a gun now. And actually, I have some of the quotes because I'm presenting on this work in a couple days. He says, you know, everyone has a weapon. So this is somebody who does not own a gun. Sometimes I lay down in my bed and I think about it. If someone breaks into my house and I have nothing to protect myself with. And so, you know, there's this kind of line about like gun curiosity. So this is David Yamane is coming in all over this. You know, this idea that there's a lot of people who are curious about guns. And there's definitely that. We've definitely seen people who are, you know, and talked to people who are curious about learning more, curious about what this is all about. There's a lot of gun panic and a lot of gun ambivalence and a lot of sort of, I don't know what to do. I think I need to do this. You know, we've also kind of received sort of this sense, and some interviewees have really explicitly said this at the end, like, thank you for giving me a chance to reflect on things that I haven't been able to reflect on, or thank you for giving me the chance to sort of process, you know, these questions. We've also had people who are like, hey, I'm really excited, you know, and this is mostly the pro gun rights advocate side, who are like, I'm really excited I get to talk to researchers and sort of, you know, talk about John Lott or talk about whatever. And so, so it's created this interesting space. So to pull it back to sort of like, what
Are people actually quoting John Lott in their responses?
Some of them. Wow. Well, at least one. And so, you know, we have this sort of interesting moment that we're in. It's a moment where we know, although I just looked at the data. So I guess confidence in higher ed is like ticked up a little bit. Like there's a little bit more trust. So I don't know what that little blip is about. But, you know, it's been pretty dramatically on the decline. I think that we as researchers, we often think about like, oh, it's the I have to produce better knowledge, whatever that means, or I have to produce, you know, somehow the research output has to somehow speak more to the public and somehow they're not getting it. And what this project has made me realize is that it's not just about the product, it's about the process, and that we are actually, you know, we can talk about the classroom as like a space for civic engagement. This research is also a space for civic engagement. It's also a space for person who is a, you know, research participant, a research assistant, to come together and have a conversation that, you know, especially in this moment where we're so polarized, we're so a lot of things right in terms of what's happened in the last year, I've really come to appreciate the value of gun research. And again, I would say it's not just any topic you could do this with. I think that coming at it with a topic like guns, where at the end, you know, part, and this is also something that we've gotten as feedback, like, I thought your questions were going to be really biased and they weren't. And that was cool. Mm. And, you know, I'm kind of like, yeah, that means that person now, who knows what they'll do, but they're not going to tell their friends how they had the interview with the ASU researchers and like, oh my gosh, it's so biased. They might actually say that they were surprised that like, actually we asked questions that they didn't expect. They got to think through their answers and maybe, you know, saw that we're not all totally biased in one direction or another in terms of doing this hot button research topic. So
wow,
that's my number three.
That was such an exciting moment for me because for our listeners not directly involved with Bridges, I don't work directly on the American Gun Experience Project, even though I work with many of the RAs involved in other contexts. So I get these little glimpses of what y'all are up to, but this was really inspiring and amazing that you're doing that on top of everything that we do together. So my third one was going hunting with David Yumani, a highlight for me.
David, you are so beloved at Bridges.
And I will say a couple things about that. So I met David, as I met you, at the Amherst Colloquium I mentioned earlier, and became connected with him on social media. And we'd had this kind of years-long relationship just on social media, which is probably never healthy, right? Where we went back and forth, occasionally had these contentious moments where David was very critical of my research. I was occasionally critical of his. I wrote a review of his book that was, I think, largely positive, but critical about a couple of moments, you know, and wasn't sure sort of where that relationship was going to go. But kept up with him and you know, had these friendly exchanges. And then finally, maybe almost as a dare, invited David to come hunting with me in the Sonoran Desert before our symposium.
Sorry, I have to interrupt you there because it's a dare, not just because of everything you just said, but in his book, he explicitly is like, I don't want to do hunting. So it was a deep cut for you to go there.
And he said yes, and I was so excited. And we set up a hunt, and we were going to go hunting for quail and ducks, which most people don't think of Arizona desert and ducks, but believe it or not, it's a thing. We had this amazing day where we picked him up at zero dark 30 at his hotel and in a stranger's car, my friend who has a German short hair pointer who we were going hunting with, and drove him out to the middle of the desert. And he was such a good sport, never done it before, on top of all the safety things. And we were, as we were undertaking this adventure, had the opportunity to have all kinds of conversations about the field and our work, and just had an amazing day. And David, one of the things I admire about him the most, and I think the reason he's at the center of so many conversations in Bridges, is how hard he works to bring gun research to a broader audience and how he's willing to experiment in so many different ways. making that happen on social media, through Substack, through, you know, videos. In fact, tomorrow I'm recording some kind of video with him about hunting. I don't know what we're going to talk about, but our listeners can look forward to that. Or knowing David's quick production schedule, it'll probably be out before before this is out. But, you know, it was just one of those moments for me that was cool, because we have, I feel like, kind of internalized as a field. And here's where I'll reintroduce my usual debates with David, that I think David does in so many ways stand at the center of our field, even though he's often talks about being marginalized within it. In that,
did
I think
you hear that, David?
Yeah,
you are
yeah.
the center of gun studies. You are not marginalized within gun studies.
That David's taking up of the popular term gun culture 2.0 and really theorizing it has become such an important tool for so many of us, including myself. I mean, I teach David sociology of gun culture whenever I teach. Hunting plays an interesting role in that story. And I feel like David, in going hunting, was kind of able to reassess some things. And he's been reassessing things in a lot of his public-facing work as he's been working on his upcoming book on gun culture 2.0 about what do we do with that narrative. And, you know, David is often skeptical of grand narratives of one kind or another, right? And I think, to his credit, he's kind of thinking critically about what we miss with a gun culture 2.0 heuristic. And I think one of the things we do is the persistence of hunting cultures within gun culture, right? Like, even if people are saying self-defense is more important now, this is something that's persisted, as has maintained a central kind of cultural place in how we think about guns, and an important kind of material role in how guns in America work as well. So
yeah, I think that's something actually that's been very interesting about the American Gun Experience interviews, which is that, you know, when we ask people about why do you own guns, it's very much in line with gun culture 2.0, which would make you think, oh, it's all about self-defense. But sort of people's affective relationships with guns are not reducible to gun culture 2.0, because, and this is gun owners, people who don't own guns, hunting and hunting with dad is like all over.
Oh, wow.
All over. And wow. I mean, the amount of stories that people, you know, people, I don't own any guns, but I have these wonderful memories of hunting with my dad.
Hmm.
Or I have memories of not hunting and I feel like that was something I wish I would have done.
Oh,
or
wow.
I wish that there were, you know, I think David talks about this. I think you've talked about it, that it's, you know, it's not a one replaces the other. There's layers and layers.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that it's, and in some ways I feel like my work, you know, some of the things that I've tried to really emphasize is that, you know, people are turning to guns to solve problems. Like, this is not like, they are using the tools at their disposal. And I think that that's very helpful in terms of illuminating what guns are doing for people. But it doesn't get at this sort of emotional and effect. And I think when people start talking about emotional attachments to guns, oh God, nobody wants to have that conversation because everybody on all sides of the gun debate wants to tell the other side that they're the emotional hysterical one. So like, as soon as you start talking about emotions, it's like, you know, bad news.
Yeah.
But so I'm a vegan. I have not gone hunting. I don't know what I would do if you asked me to go hunting. I don't know how I would answer that. When we don't engage hunting, we miss a huge opportunity to understand this emotional attachment. That's really complicated. And it's not just to guns. It's mediated through family. It's mediated through all these things. So. Mm. Yeah.
We got to do our vegan and hunter episode.
I know. We have to
point.
Do the vegan hunter episode.
Have you encountered any of the vegan to hunter pipeline literature?
I mean, I think it's, I think somebody who is hunting for, if you're doing that as a way to opt out of the factory farm industry, farm. Like,
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great. This also kind of dovetails to my number four, which is, the spaces that we have been able to open, this is a broad one. This is like a double, there's mm-hmm. like two events. So specifically, we had a retreat in Colorado that was called The End of the Gun Debate as We Know It, Reimagining the Field Before It Gets Rewritten. And then we had an invite-only small, you know, and the goal was to have a small group to facilitate conversation, shared targets, supporting collaboration across researchers and firearm industry experts. And there were different events. So one was all academics, thinking about gun studies and its future. The other was sort of bringing together people who are from the firearms industry, who are open to having conversations across sort of different lines, and then scholars, academics, public health scholars, social scientists, and what have you. And so two different events that we got to host this year at Bridges. And in both of those events, I really was just amazed and astonished at the vulnerability that people brought to those spaces. One of the ways that that happened, which is the link to the moment you just described, so particularly at Shared Target. So this is an event with a lot of public health scholars, gun people, social scientists, and we all introduced ourselves. And the number of academics who were like, I own a gun. I grew up hunting. I target shoot. I mean, I was just like, this is like wild. This is not like, I wish like all the people who are like academics hate guns. I'm like, can you just like look, like, I know we agreed that this was going to be a closed door event, but like, can we just record this? So that was pretty amazing. And, you know, in some ways I already knew that, right? And you already probably knew that too, because we, when we go and give talks, like we're always the ones that like the academics are like, you know,
confide in.
Yeah, like I actually have a gun, or, you know, in 2020, I bought a gun. And you're like, okay, all right, you're not, you're special, but you're not that special. Like, thank you. But then the other flip side of that was not just the sort of openness about sort of crossing that line with like the gun ownership piece, but also exposure to gun violence and exposure to being a gun violence survivor. And in both of those spaces, I was just really amazed at the way that people situated on all sides of this debate in all different aspects of the conversation were willing to show up and willing to be vulnerable, willing to talk about, you know, I think there's a sense that like, you know, the gun rights people, the only reason you can love guns that much is because you've never experienced a negative consequence of a gun, right? Or a negative, you know, a negative outcome. That's just not true. That is just not true. And it's really not only dehumanizing of people to assume that of them, but it's also debasing of yourself because you're not allowing yourself the chance to be in a space of what is a really complex, vulnerable thing. And again, that obviously goes back to why we're doing this research with the American Gun Experience, because it's not the case that there are, you know, the gun owners over here, the gun violence survivors over there, and then the academics somehow playing like referee and we're above all of it. Like, that's just not how it works. And we can say that and we can know it, but to actually be in those spaces, and I mean, tears were shed like in this year where it just, there's so much vile rhetoric, there's so much hate, there's so much political violence, to have people who have been told or who we tell ourselves like, oh, these people couldn't possibly be in a room together and sit with each other and hold each other's humanity, that like, actually, no, that's completely possible. And I think we're really all very hungry for it. So when sort of I had the like bright idea of like, oh, I should should try and start an initiative that is not, you know, focused on one side of the gun debate. We're not about one corner of the gun debate. Like, we're about building bridges. I think that a lot of people looked at my proposal and were like, cute idea, but not possible. And I definitely think that, you know, this year, I mean, it's doom and gloom in terms of being able to talk across divides. I think it's not a coincidence that, and I'm just going to like plug, like ASU is awesome because ASU is willing to take risks that I think other institutions wouldn't take. And yeah, I think the risk is paying off. Like, the proof of concept is there. And so, you know, it's kind of like, how do we level this up to move even forward?
So my number four is basically the same.
Oh, good.
but I guess I did have some different perspectives on it, although I think conclusion's basically the same. But I mean, that the Shared Targets event for me, you know, and I, to your credit, you and Emmy Betts from University of Colorado Entrance Campus were
yes.
instrumental
oh,
in putting
I should
it
totally,
together.
Yes, this was Whereas, a co-organized.
Yeah.
I did not mean
No.
But, thank
you. I just wanted to say I'm not taking credit for the event. I was just was able to turn up and, you know, experience this moment with all of you. But to me, there were a couple of things that stood out from that event that helped me put some things together. You know, one was, and this is dovetails very closely with what you were saying, but that interesting conversation we had at the beginning about the firearms community, because I think that's the first panel was labeled that, and thinking about,
well,
like, everyone was kind of saying, what does that
mean?
Of
the people, we're not, like, basically there was like kind of a, if you don't want to be publicly associated with, because we had a lot of people that, you would not expect would be in that room.
Yeah.
And so, but we had Chad King, Michael mm-hmm. Sodini. Who else did we have? Ashley Hiblinski. I think that we can name all of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And on the firearm side.
Yeah. 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 And David Giamani was there. It, you know, immediately kind of started this interesting, well, like, what do we mean by firearms community? And in that conversation, it just made me realize how often we have versions of this conversation in our field, whether we're talking about the term gun owner. Are we talking about anybody who owns a gun, or are we talking about a particular politicized subset of those people, et cetera, you know? When we even talk about the term gun culture, I should have some version of a swear jar where I have to deposit every time I cite Richard Hofstadter, but here we go. But thinking about Hofstadter's essay that has been so often cited in the field, right? To me, what remains one of the most interesting things about that essay is his insistence that we're dealing with this in a national frame. Thinking on it transnationally is even more interesting. But I think politically, we still tend to use that term gun culture, and it could be firearms community too, right? As thinking about this subculture that is politically important, but distinct somehow, right? And over the course of that conversation, we can, oh, wait, well, the academics, we're gun owners too. And like, what do you do about that? And you know, are we talking about, you know, why, what about survivors advocates, or, you know, what's their relation to the firearms community? And what about people who are both gun owners and firearms advocates, of which there are so many there? And I think, you know, in the kind of productive confusion that arose out of that just conversation about terminology, I think was indicative for me of the importance of expanding this conversation and just the ways that we're working to do so. And then, you know, the second moment from that, I actually talked to the person I'm going to cite here to make sure she was okay with talking about that. But after that initial firearms community panel, Nelba Marquez Green at Public Health at Yale. She holds this very interesting, unique position. She's a counselor and focusing on grief counseling, is a community scholar at Yale, and they have a whole community of folks involved in firearms violence prevention there. But she's also a mother of a girl killed at Sandy Hook, and somehow I had missed that part of her bio kind of going into it. And it was really... I'm not one of these gun scholars who is brought to the field by a mass shooting that really kind of mobilized me. And that's the kind of origin story of so many people in our field, you know. But I have taught, along with David's work, I think something I teach almost every time is Patrick Blanchfield's essay, The Ghosts of 2012, which for me was one of the first kind of public-facing pieces of intellectual writing on gun culture that just opened up so much for me in terms of how the media frames these conversations about these horrific events. But then, you know, how do you take a wider lens on it while still kind of holding the horror of those events? And learning about Nelba's work was so inspiring that she has really kind of moved with that trajectory, right? Like moving beyond the kind of immediate horror of Sandy Hook to kind of thinking about neighborhoods kind of impacted by endemic gun violence. And so I was so inspired by her. And, you know, there was this moment at the end of that panel where she had a tough time, I think, being in that space, you know, and I think a lot of people might have at the beginning, you know, that she was, it makes me think of Lindsay Livingston's work on guns and performance. There was a kind of performance to be analyzed in that room as people were kind of struggling to come together. And she was having difficulty even sitting at the table, you know, but was able to ask of that panel, you know, do you ever think about the victims, right? And immediately the room kind of erupted, and there was this initial kind of defensive reaction from a lot of people and from her, you know, but it kind of resolved into that vulnerability you're talking about, right? It went from an event that had been kind of, you know, formal and friendly, but, you know, just kind of like people staying in their lanes, kind of to something where all that kind of fell apart. And in that moment of vulnerability, and, you know, that could have derailed the whole conversation with another set of people, but the fact that everybody was in there looking to work through that was a beautiful thing to me, and something I'll never forget. And I think Nelba for it afterwards. And it's a question that I think will resonate with me as I continue forward in this work too.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting and odd that when everybody gave their bios, it really was focused on like my relationship with guns as a gun owner. And I know, I mean, myself included, although I didn't give a bio because I got skipped over because I was one of the organizers.
Oh,
so it was like, I was like, oh, I guess I didn't even have a chance to disclose or not disclose. But there were a lot of people who were carrying experiences of surviving gun violence, being exposed to gun violence. And that wasn't the self-presentation that people brought to the table when they, you know, gave their bios, which was interesting. But then with that question, that became that the sort of center of gravity shifted. And it wasn't, and it was interesting because it, again, it wasn't like one side versus the other. It was like, oh, this is how we're going to reframe this conversation now. Now we're going to get into this space of vulnerability. And I also think, I mean, I kind of want to go back to the comment you made about sort of thinking about gun culture and national gun culture. You know, I do think that, yeah, this point of like the U.S. doesn't have a gun culture. Well, it doesn't have its gun cultures. But, you know, the U.S. doesn't have a gun culture. It is a gun culture. I think that's also where, you know, and I'm just sorry, this is like side note, but whatever, we can we can do a tangent. You know, thinking about sort of gun culture 1.0, which is, you know, hunting oriented gun culture 2.0, which is self-defense, and then gun culture 3.0, which is where, I mean, we can talk about what we're going to think about that, but that I feel like of those three, you know, the progression might not be so much like, oh, it's hunting versus self-defense versus, you know, democratic decline or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's more how unavoidable does gun culture become? Mm. And gun culture 1.0 is the most subculture of that.
Oh,
gun culture 2.0 is like, this is looking like this is kind of what we do. And once you get to gun culture 3.0, that's when you have people that I'm, you know, that we're interviewing, staying up in bed, freaking out because they have to participate and they don't have a choice. And so, you know, I feel like in some ways that might be another way to think about. And like, it's always, the U.S. has always been a gun culture, right? So it's more that sense of, is this something that I even feel I have a choice to opt in or opt out of? And I think that that conversation also may be part of the reason that that was possible in 2025 and not in 2010 or 2005 is because this sense of like, we can't opt out of this has become that much more palpable. So there's something to think about there. Okay, so let me get to then my final moment of the 2025, and it really relates to what we've been talking about in terms of sort of crisscrossing, getting caught up in the tangle threads of guns in America or guns in the United States. And if you've been involved at all with Bridges over the last year, you probably know what I'm talking about. We're actually going to talk about this a lot more in a future episode, so not going to get too much into it now, but I was very much directly impacted by gun violence earlier this year, which made it so that I have not only had to rethink how I engage this work, how I present myself, which I guess was the one, I guess, silver lining of not having to give my bio initially at that event, because I don't know, I'm not actually sure what I would have said. I was in a position where I needed to take some leave, and I have very much always been, you know, the kind of annoying academic where I try to do everything myself and I don't know how to delegate. And I am so grateful because I realized when I had no choice, I had to step away. And I'm going to try not to cry. I realized that I had an incredible team. Obviously, Alex, Laurel, our senior program coordinator, many, many people at ASU who stepped up, the Bridges Fellows who were supportive in all sorts of ways. I mean, I'm not going to be able to list everybody, and so I'm not even going to try because I'm going to feel bad if I miss anybody. My moment was realizing that I had this incredible community that I, you know, I knew people, I knew I could persuade people to like, hey, we should do this thing, Bridges. It's like going to be a totally different kind of initiative in the social sciences, guns. But, you know, to see people be so supportive and really go above and beyond, you know, one of the things with gun violence is that it is sort of a like a passing along of trauma. You experience it. Well, the person who does it is passing the trauma on to you. And then in sort of the wake of chaos, you have all these people who show up and you know, do so much to try and fix what is unfixable. And I just, yeah, I am overwhelmed with gratitude of, you know, for all of the people who my colleagues, but really colleagues is not a good enough word, my friends and really angels who stepped in and made it so that so much of the work from the podcast, the symposium, the Bridges Fellowship, none of this would have happened had it not been for, and, you know, I really want to give a shout out to you, Alex. Like, it would not, like, this all should have fallen apart. It really should have. And I just really can't thank you enough.
Oh, no. I mean, I can't thank you enough for the trust you put in me and Laurel and the whole team. And I guess my last one also relates to that difficult time, you know, when you had to go on leave and dealing with those tragic circumstances. And Laurel and I had the symposium ahead of us, which we'd worked so hard on with you, but you are, and still are, of course, but are so much the center of everything that happens here. And it just felt like trying to put together a puzzle, but missing the most important pieces, you know, and that those weeks and then kind of losing track of the conversations I had with your friends and colleagues. Give me a second. You know, when it all really came together for me, I think when it finally came together was at the final event for that conference. We were all at the 13th floor downtown, where this amazing view of the Phoenix skyline and people had given these amazing talks. And Laurel and I had been kind of working so hard to make sure it all came together again, you know, feeling like we were kind of walking this tightrope, but and you know, dealing with the emotions of it all at the same time. But finally, when we were all able to come together at that happy hour and we decided to all take a picture and send it to you. And just seeing those people there and seeing people I'd had very tough conversations with, kind of happy and kind of hopeful about the community that you had put together. And it really is a tribute to your work that it all came together, and I was so happy to play a part in it. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So we managed to take like a really dark year and be like, how can we end this on like the darkest note? We started with swag and now.
Yeah, I know.
I
hope I didn't.
We'll be talking more about this. And, you know, one of the things that I think we maybe can end on, and again, I could spend the rest of the year saying thank you, because I can't say thank you enough. But for the sake of our listeners, we'll be coming back and circling back to so much of this. We have a lot of exciting stuff coming up in 2026, where I think we're going to be coming back to this year and many of the themes of this year. One thing that's on the agenda is Guns Unpacked is actually going to SHOT Show in Las Vegas. And so we are really excited to see how that takes shape and bring you that very special episode. I think we're really excited about maintaining our commitment to not just having the conversations that need to happen and that we need to be having to build bridges across the space that we're told is so divided, but also making sure that, you know, our listeners are aware that actually there's a lot more of the conversation of these conversations that are already happening, but we don't talk about it. So we don't know. And I think that's definitely this year. I feel like that has been one of the really powerful themes for me.
100%. And so much of the exciting work that we had the opportunity to talk about here is still yet to come in season two. So our live episode featuring Yasser Payne, Brooklyn Hitchens, and Daryl Chambers is coming out next, and our interview with Kelly Carter Jackson as well. So a lot of exciting things on the horizon.